Under the arc of weather-stained boards, ancient goblins and warlords come out the ground, not making a sound. The smell of death is all around. And the night when the cold wind blows, no one cares, nobody knows. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. Cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. Hey
everybody, welcome to another episode of F This Movie, the official podcast of fthismovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show because I have a special guest here to talk about 2019's remake, reimagining, readaptation of Stephen King's Pet Sematary is East Coast's finest, Robin Buckley. Hi, Robin.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Can you please do this whole thing in a Maine accent?
No. Listen,
they mostly steered clear of the Maine accents in this remake.
They did. They did fine. And also, like, Maine accent for me, because I'm New Hampshire, is like Maine border, which is basically people from Massachusetts coming up.
Okay.
So I don't have a Maine accent that I can go with.
Got it. I don't either. I can try and imitate Fred Gwynne in the original Pet Sematary, but no one wants that. Literally no one. Well, no, it's something, but
not a human accent.
it sounds the way Stephen King reads sometimes, because he tries to write with that accent, and which is interesting. Anyway, we're going to be talking about Pet Sematary. We'll talk spoiler-free for a few minutes, and then we will get into spoilers because it is a new release. Made a bunch of money this weekend. Not quite Shazam money, but listen, who among us can aspire to Shazam money? first, I want to remind everyone you still have time to vote for F This Movie in the Rondo Awards. Go to the Rondo website, and our Toby Hooper Memorial is nominated way down at the bottom of the page. You don't have to nominate in every category. I know the ballot can seem daunting and confusing, but it's really just a copy and paste that you put into an email. And vote for us there, because that would be cool. Robin, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. I've kind of been watching a lot of old stuff, except the only new thing I've watched was I finally saw Free Solo.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen it yet.
I think it might be the scariest movie I've seen in a while.
That's why I haven't seen it yet.
I was like really tense the entire time. I don't understand the mindset that would make you want to climb at all, but climb without any sort of equipment.
Yeah.
Is just, it was terrifying. It was very good.
Does it hold up? Because I know, you know, I didn't see it theatrically, and there was like a week where they were showing it in IMAX, and that seemed far too daunting to me. So do you feel like it holds up at home?
It holds up. I think it would probably work a lot better.
Okay.
In like the IMAX, because there was scenes where it's kind of close up on him climbing, and then it goes away and it shows how high he is and just like the vastness of the land around him. And on like the TV in my house, I was like, yeah, that's really cool. And I was getting a little bit of vertigo and stuff. But I think if it had been on an IMAX screen, I probably would have just like vomited from fear. and it's definitely worth checking out. Just like the guy's personality is so intense and so driven. And like, again, I don't have that personality. So I had a hard time relating to him.
Sure.
But he made for an interesting subject.
Okay.
And then the like older things I've seen is I watched My Man Godfrey.
Oh, yay.
From, I think it's from like 1936, maybe. Yeah. And I don't think I'd seen anything with Carole Lombard or William Powell. I loved it.
Yeah.
Like I know I like the screwball comedies, but sometimes I kind of get away and I won't watch them for a long time. And then I'll watch one and I'll be like, these are so good. They're just so entertaining.
That one is especially good.
Yeah. And I, the whole time I was watching, I was like, I just want to see this as a play. Like, yeah. Cause it reads like that. And it was just, oh, the dialogue. It's hilarious. If anybody hasn't seen it, I'm sure they all have. Everybody has, but check it out.
It feels very, except for like all of the talk about the forgotten man. I mean, there's certain class things that I know are somewhat outdated, but I feel like Carole Lombard's performance in particular feels very modern in the way that mm-hmm. she's playing kind of this a little bit flaky, definitely spoiled, but like her heart is in the right place.
Yeah, she's still sweet.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's an amazing, I don't want to spoil that scene at the end where he talks to each member of the family, but like, it's so good. William Powell is, you know, an actor I've only discovered probably in the last 10 or 15 years, but man, mm-hmm. every time I see him in anything, it's like, he's so, so, so good. I could watch him in any single movie.
Yeah. I did have a hard time getting used to, like, I think it was, like, Carlo, the, like...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's the sponsor or whatever it is. Right. And I was like, this is a level of, like, rich person slash weird person that I do not understand. But I think my favorite character might have been the sister, Cornelia. Like, she was such a jerk.
Yeah, so
she played
good.
It so well.
Yeah, 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 yeah. No, that Erica and I just watched that a few months ago. It's so good.
Yeah. And then I have a Hitchcock like DVD set that I've had for a long time. And I have a tendency to kind of go back and rewatch, you know, Vertigo, Rear Window, Psycho, like ones I've seen. And so I kind of made it a goal to watch some that I had not watched before. So I will not go into specifics or get like really in depth for any of them. But over the, like the last week, I watched Torn Curtain, Family Plot, The Trouble with Harry, and Frenzy.
All right.
Have you seen any of those ones? Or have you seen all of them?
The only one I have a clear memory of is Frenzy. Like, I know I've seen Family Plot, but I would need to see it again. I don't think I've seen the other two, but Frenzy I know pretty well.
So Torn Curtain is Paul Newman and Julie Andrews, and I'm not entirely sure I think Julie Andrews works in Hitchcock film. Like, she's almost too sweet, and this is a spy thriller, like Soviet Cold War. Mm-hmm. And she's Julie Andrews. Like, she seems so sweet. Paul Newman works. He is able to play the kind of that kind of spy thriller character totally fine. There's a fight scene in it that is like for its time. It's a very intense fight scene where it's almost completely silent because they're trying to be quiet, and it's just like the sounds of like breathing and just like thuds that made like, I don't know, it could have been a little slapsticky or a little bit like over the top, and instead it was just, I was like silently watching, being like, how is this fight scene going to go?
Right.
And then The Trouble with Harry was, I think, 55, and it's Shirley MacLaine's first film role. And she's adorable. And she works better because it's straight comedy. Which usually I feel like you have like a little twist with Hitchcock movies, but Trouble with Harry is basically like, there's a dead body, and he's not important. It's kind of a MacGuffin kind of thing, but everybody's trying to hide the body because different people think they accidentally killed this guy. And so the body keeps getting like buried and then dug up and then buried again. John, I think it's John Forsythe. That sounds right. Is in it as well. And it was really funny. And then Frenzy is a serial killer one.
Right.
And you said you've seen that.
I have seen that one. Yeah.
I liked the fact that you know who the killer is the whole time. Like it's the entire time, you know who who it is.
Right.
They're not trying to like, there's no mystery. And then I think like the most probably famous scene with that movie is there's like a body in a potato truck. And it's the serial killer trying to get something off the body. And it's so tense.
Yeah.
And I was watching it and I'm like, you can do it, buddy. And then I was like, wait, no, like I don't want him to get this. And then Family Plot might have been my fave. I think I might have my favorite. That one was a little bit of a thriller, but it was also funny. It's Bruce Dern, Barbara Harris, Karen Black, and a person who I'm blanking on their name. Again, I don't think I realized how adorable Barbara Harris is before. And then, so those are my kind of Hitchcocks of the week. And then I went down a bit of a like Karen Black hole, and I realized I'd only seen one of the segments, but I rewatched Trilogy of Terror.
Oh,
and
yeah, okay.
It turns out I've only seen the one with, like, the warrior doll.
The Zuni fetish doll, yeah.
Because I feel like that's probably the most famous one.
Yeah.
But I liked all three, and I don't know if I realized how great she is just playing all of the different parts. And the, like, again, the last shot of Trilogy of Terror, I'm not saying anything that hasn't been said before, but that's so awesome.
I only saw that for the first time last October, and I don't remember any of it. Like, I couldn't even tell you what the other two segments are right now.
So one of them is she's getting blackmailed by a student who takes, like, pictures of her. It's real creepy. He drugs her and, like, takes pictures of her and then blackmails her. And then there's a twist. And then the second one is about twin sisters, and one of them gets, like, a voodoo doll to kill the other sister. And then there's a twist.
I am just going to have to take your word for it on both, because even you saying it, I'm like, did I watch that movie? I really thought I did, and yet here we are. So
well,
maybe
rhymes. So
all right, I'll definitely watch it again.
She does a good job, like playing so many different characters, especially because like, she's carrying the entire movie.
Yeah.
And again, she's really good in Family Plot. Like, she's great in that one. I don't know. I was like, oh, it's a Karen Black marathon.
Yeah, I need to rewatch Family Plot because I know I saw it years ago, and I like Trilogy of Terror, which I only saw months ago. I don't remember any of it. And just between Karen Black and Bruce Dern, like, I feel like, oh, that's a movie for me. So I definitely need to see it. Karen Black is a weird one because so much of my knowledge of her comes from like the late 80s and some of her more recent stuff where she's usually playing like kind of a weirdo, like she's in, mm-hmm. you know, House of a Thousand Corpses or Invaders from Mars, you know, she's giving a very stylized performance. So then when I go back and see stuff with her from the 70s, I'm like, oh, right. She was actually a really good actor who didn't always play a giant weirdo.
Was she like Easy Rider in Five Easy Pieces and stuff? She was in like,
yeah,
a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's great.
And then even in like Family Plot, like she plays, it's not like it's in kind of the synopsis of the movie, but like she's like a bad guy, but she doesn't play it as like anything over the top or really crazy. It's just like she's just in it for the money. It was Hitchcock's last movie, which was interesting.
Yeah.
I think I started watching, except it was on Amazon Prime, but it was like terrible quality. I was watching, I think, one of his like really early 1930s movies the other day. And I was like, if I could just watch this one, and then I've watched Family Plot, I've seen, you know, the full spectrum.
Yeah, right.
But it was, the quality and the sound was unwatchable.
Amazon Prime is very frustrating with that. Because, sometimes I'll find stuff that I'm really excited to come across, and then I'll put it on. And, yeah, it's like, if I could watch it in this format, which is to say, like, I don't know that I can, but even if I force myself to, I'm not doing the movie any favors.
Like, no.
by watching like an eighth generation VHS dub of this movie that deserves better. So I wish they had better quality control over there.
When I watched My Man Godfrey, it was on Amazon Prime, and it was like the colorized version, and I was like,
God damn it.
I was like, I'll do it because this is the one
right,
that's there.
Right.
And like, it was fine. Like, it wasn't bad to look at, but I was like, I feel like this is not how this movie is meant for me to be watching.
Right. How hard is it? Even just to put both on there, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I guess if
no, you have to pay for the other one.
Right, exactly. I guess if people really want the colorized one, like, sure, give them the option. But, yeah, it's very frustrating. And, you know, more and more, they're becoming, like, sort of a go-to because Netflix's catalog keeps shrinking.
Oh, yeah.
To anything that isn't a Netflix original, you know. And I haven't yet watched Brie Larson's Unicorn Store. So, for the time being, I'd much rather watch stuff on Amazon Prime, but yeah, it's just, it's so hit or miss with them, you know?
I almost watched Unicorn Store the other night, and then I watched like the plays when you know, when yeah. you're selecting through, and yeah. I sat there and I watched the trailer and I said, you know, no.
This is no, my I'm exact good. Experience. I was like, Brie Larson directed a movie? Of course I'll watch it. Okay, yeah. Let me see this trailer. No, I think I'll watch something else.
Yeah, I went and started watching the new Netflix Our Planet, and that was super depressing. So I was like, never mind.
Oh, geez.
TV off.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awful.
Yikes. All right, great.
Well, that's all I have for good stuff lately.
All right. Well, speaking of streaming services, as of this recording, the new Criterion channel just launched yesterday, and I was, for my birthday, gifted a subscription to the Criterion channel by Doug. And so I wanted to watch something on its opening day and didn't know what to choose because there's so much stuff on there. So I just went with the first in what they have a whole, like, basically playlist of old film noir made at Columbia. And you can watch them basically almost as a season. So it's like a continuous play function. You can watch a little intro and then the movies will just play one after another so that you never have to get up or leave your house. So I just watched the first one, which is from 1945, called My Name is Julia Ross. It was a movie I'd never even heard of. And it stars Nina, oh gosh, I don't even know how to say her name, F-O-C-H, Foch?
Let's go with the first.
Sure, yeah. It's an English film noir, which I thought was kind of interesting. And she's a woman who goes to apply for a job. And the job is not exactly what it seems to be. And suddenly this family that she's been hired to work as a secretary for insists on calling her by a different name and treating her as though she's someone else. And I won't say any more than that. But yeah, it's an interesting setup. Some really, really beautiful photography. You know, not the best film noir I've ever seen. I don't even know how memorable it's going to be, but I'm happy to have seen it and happy for the opportunity to be exposed to it because, like I said, I'd never even heard of it. So I like that this channel is already programming stuff that I would not come across otherwise.
Very nice. I do not have Criterion Channel, and now I'm thinking maybe I should.
The first 30 days are free.
Okay.
So you can subscribe and check it out. I know Bugsy Malone is on there, which is like not available in any format and I think has been written about a couple times on our site. I think JB wrote about it. And I want to say Heath Holland wrote about it. So that's maybe the next thing I'm going to watch because I think I had Filmstruck for a short time, but I never really took advantage of Filmstruck the way I should have. And then it went away and everyone was mourning it. And I was like, oh, yeah, I should have done better by Filmstruck. So I'm trying to be good about getting the most out of this Criterion subscription. Erica and I watched Looker for the first time, written and directed by Michael Crichton. Are you familiar with this one?
No.
Okay, so it's basically this tech company that is creating artificial intelligence in that it'll take models. It'll tell them exactly what their imperfections are. They go in and have these plastic surgeries, and it's literally like a 0.3 millimeter adjustment on my nose. And then once they're deemed perfect, it will scan their bodies and then use them in advertising. And the actor doesn't have to be present anymore. They just become this virtual actor, basically. Albert Finney is in it. He's the plastic surgeon who kind of gets wrapped up in this plot, and Susan Day is in it. It's, you know, like most movies directed by Michael Crichton, he's great at premises. Like, he has really interesting ideas. I mean, Westworld is an interesting idea. Jurassic Park, even though it's basically Westworld, is a great premise. The difference with Jurassic Park is that you have an interesting premise and then a director who knows how to do the most with it. Michael Crichton is not that director. So, really interesting premise, so far ahead of its time because it's talking about stuff that's happening now, basically, with, you know, CG actors. And, you know, we have.
Well, I was going to say, they do that to people who've passed away.
Exactly. We have Carrie Fisher and Peter Cushing showing up in Rogue One. And we have, right, Humphrey Bogart and John Wayne showing up in commercials. We have Tupac holograms at concerts. There was a movie a couple of years ago called The Congress with Robin Wright, which was totally about this very same thing. And so it's fascinating to me that here's this movie from 1981 that's already talking about it. So really intriguing science fiction concepts, not always executed the best, because the second half of the movie kind of drags and it's only a 90-minute movie. But, you know, good enough to be worth watching, I think.
Okay. I'll check that out. I mean, I like Michael Crichton. I like his books, I think, more than I like the movies he's directed.
But I don't think I've read many of his books. I feel like the only book of his that I actually finished was Rising Sun, and I don't think that's the one to really, like, measure Michael Crichton by.
I think I went down, like, there was a period in high school where I think, like, all I was reading was Michael Crichton and, like, Stephen King. So it was just, like, a lot of Jurassic Park, Lost World, Congo, like, a lot of the books, Timeline, Prey, which was just about, like, nanobot things. I don't know. At a certain point, I was like, this man is terrified of technology.
He sure is, and yet kind of knew where things were going at the same time.
Yes, yes.
I've seen most of the movies based on those books that you named. I saw Timeline. I saw Congo.
I remember I read Timeline, and I, like, really liked it, and then the movie came out, and I was like, oh, no.
I don't remember.
Same
it
with,
well,
like, Congo. It was just some of the movies aren't the best.
No.
I mean, Jurassic Park is my favorite. I've, like, finally come to not accept, but I feel like I always wanted to be, like, I don't know, fancier. And then finally I just accepted that Jurassic Park is my favorite movie. And I was just like, this is my favorite movie.
That is not a bad favorite movie to have.
Yeah, but, like, I've said it to people who, for some reason, you know, I think that I'm, like, hoity-toity movie stuff. And they're just like, really? That? And I'm like, yes. And they're like, you don't want something, like, better? And I was like, what do you mean better?
Well, like, I mean,
so great.
If someone asks you your favorite food and you say pizza, they're like, yeah, I get it. Pizza's awesome. Like, Jurassic Park is awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like, what more do you want from a movie than what Jurassic Park has to offer?
I was like, I might not say it's the best movie ever, right, although I might also make that argument. But it is a favorite movie.
Yeah, no, it's everything a movie should be. I saw a movie from last year called The Clovehitch Killer, which stars Dylan McDermott as this sort of nebbishy suburban dad whose son begins to suspect might be a serial killer, which is not a particularly new or novel premise. There was a movie that came out a couple years ago called I'm Not a Serial Killer that was about a similar thing, except it was a neighbor and Christopher Lloyd was the character. And I really, really loved that movie. I'm more lukewarm on The Clovehitch Killer. I'd heard a lot of people praise it. It ended up on some top 10 lists for horror last year. I thought it was okay. You know, I thought it worked decently as a family drama, as a suspense film, or as a horror film. It kind of left me cold. My guess is it will show up on Netflix Instant pretty soon because it's an IFC title and they seem to get those movies almost day and date. So when that movie does come out on Blu-ray or DVD, if it's not already, my guess is it'll show up on Netflix if you're at all interested. But it's kind of a pass for me.
Okay. I was going to say, do I check it out? But
No, I would.
Or do I just watch the Christopher Lloyd movie?
I would watch I'm Not a Serial Killer, yeah, because I like that movie way more. And then the last movie I'll talk about, some friends got together the other day and we did a marathon of movies, ending with a little movie called Waterworld, and not just any edition of Waterworld, but the famed 3-hour Ulysses cut of Waterworld, which is all of the stuff. When it originally aired on TV, they added a bunch of scenes back in and split it up over 2 nights. And then over the years, some fans put together this thing called the Ulysses cut, which is the TV cut plus some deleted shots and footage that were censored from the US cut but were included in the European version of the movie. So this is like everything you can find, basically. It's like the uncut version of Waterworld plus all the extra TV stuff. So it runs about 3 hours. And when Arrow put Waterworld out on Blu-ray a few months ago, they included the original cut, the theatrical cut, and a new high-def restoration of this Ulysses cut. And, you know, my relationship with Waterworld is a long and storied one. I saw it back in the summer of 95, and I was like, it's okay, you know, because, again, I was reacting to so much of the hype, you know, as JB says, everyone reviewed the budget instead of responding to the movie. So I was like, well, that didn't seem like $200 million well spent, but whatever, it was fine. And then over the years, I've watched it over and over again, and I'm just at the point now where I just have to admit, I really like Waterworld, and I really like this 3-hour cut. And I can't necessarily make the case that it's a better movie, because if you don't like the movie, who's going to have the patience for it? But as someone who's a fan of the movie, it's like, hey, more to love. It spaces some stuff. It spaces some stuff out more. It provides a little bit more character stuff. But, you know, I get why the movie is not particularly loved. It's an ugly movie. It's like, it's ugly looking. They spent so much money on it and it's not an attractive movie to look at, but it does. I mean, it works the way that a big summer action movie should work. And there's a lot of great sequences, a lot of really cool stunts, a good score, a decent enough story. I mean, it's just a Mad Max ripoff. But watching Waterworld, it's like it makes me weep for the summer blockbuster of yesteryear, because when I compare it to what we get now, it's like, man, I would take one Waterworld for every 10 summer movies we get nowadays.
Well, now everything's just like a superhero Avengers movie. But not that there's anything wrong with
right.
that.
Those movies
are great.
Are good.
But you don't really get like other stuff now.
You don't get a ton of other stuff, you know. And for as much as I want to say like, well, at least Waterworld is an original concept. Like, well, it's Mad Max, but it's on the water. So it's not super original. But again, just the fact that like there are existing sets and actors performing real stunts and just, you know, there's a real tactile feeling to the whole thing. And yes, it was ridiculously expensive and a disastrous production. And like, I'm aware of all that, but to me, the end product sort of bears all that out. And so it does make me sad to see such a physical movie when that sort of thing has become more or less forgotten, because now we get mostly green screen movies.
Mm-hmm. I would say, like, was the last one that we really got that's all kind of practical, the other Mad Max Fury Road and other Mad Max.
And even that one, you know, has some CG enhancement and stuff like that. But yeah, it at least feels physical. The Mission Impossible movies are still trying to feel analog, you know. So every once in a while, and that becomes the new special effect now. The special effect is actually doing it. Which is fascinating to me. It used to be like the special effect was we convinced you that we faked it. And now it's like the novelty is Tom Cruise is actually going to do this thing. And so you guys want to come see it. Because there's a lot of shots in Waterworld where you can see that it's Kevin Costner doing the thing. And it makes a huge difference. Anyway, that's enough of my Waterworld soapbox.
I should rewatch it. I saw it when I was a kid, and I don't think I've seen it since. And I think I was colored by like being told you're not supposed to see this movie.
Right.
And I mean, I probably also saw it before I was should have been seeing it.
It. I mean, it does a lot of weird things. He is as unpleasant a hero as has ever appeared in a movie ever. I mean, he just actively wants you to dislike him. Yeah, it's...
It makes it interesting, and, like, he's an interesting actor, and I do kind of, like... I thought this when I was watching, like, some of the Hitchcock stuff, that, like, a lot of the time nowadays in movies, everybody is so pretty and just, like, almost perfect that I kind of miss when people just look like normal people.
Yeah.
And, like, Kevin Costner's handsome, but, like, also kind of just looks like a normal dude.
Right.
And I liked that. Like, here's your, like, lead of your giant blockbuster is just normal dude.
Yeah, we've gotten away from that 70s thing where, you know, your leading men were Gene Hackman and Elliot Gould. And it was like, well, these guys, you know, look like my dad. this is great, you know. Yeah, the interesting actors, you know, leading actors with character actor appearances, basically.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to Pet Sematary. We'll try to talk spoiler-free, just some general reactions to the movie. And then we will, to talk about it in any kind of detail, we'll have to be able to spoil things even more than the trailers already do.
Oh, my God.
I had my hopes up for this movie because I'm a big, big fan of Starry Eyes. I have been championing that movie for years since it came out. I think it's an amazing horror movie, one of my favorites of recent years. And so I really was happy for these filmmakers, Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer, to be getting a major studio opportunity. I will admit that the prospect of remaking Pet Sematary didn't do much for me because it wasn't a movie that I felt really needed to be remade. And initially I thought, well, we already have a Pet Sematary. Why do we need another one? And then I realized Pet Sematary is 30 years old. And so it would have been comparable when they made Pet Sematary in 1989 for me to be offended that they were remaking a movie from 1959, which at the time I would not have been offended by. I would have been like, yeah, that makes sense. That's 30 years. Of course they can remake that. So that's on me. They're fine to remake Pet Sematary. The trailers, aside from the second trailer, which gave away a big plot twist, to me looked like, oh, they're just remaking Pet Sematary with some animal masks now. So I didn't go into it with a ton of optimism, even though I really wanted to like it, because I do love Stephen King, as we all know, and I loved Starry Eyes. So I had my hopes up. Where were you at going into Pet Sematary?
I was really excited for it. I agree that I think I might have only watched the second trailer, gave away way too much, but I've read the book. I saw the 1989 one. I know the beats of the movie. So I was like, you know what, whatever. If I'm spoiled for stuff, it's fine. I was really excited. I thought that it was going, like, I was like, I'm going to be terrified. I went with one of my friends. I was more excited before I saw it. I don't have quite the relationship with Starry Eyes. I saw it when it, I think, was like first on Netflix or first came out. I liked it, but I haven't gone back to it. So I didn't have quite that like excitement for the filmmakers that you do. But I don't know if you're same as me, that your excitement was not quite there once you saw the movie.
Well, so what I said to Erica after we saw it was, well, I really hope Robin loved it, because that will make an interesting discussion.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I also will say I enjoyed it more when I was walking out, and then I started thinking about things, and we'll get into stuff in spoilers, and I was like, you know what? The further away I get from this, the less I like it. I also may have been colored by my friend that I went with has never seen the original, never read the book, didn't watch the trailers, and she really liked it. She was not scared at any point. She just found it sad and told me she cried a few times, but she said she really, really liked it. And I was like, well, good. You know, she enjoyed it. Maybe I enjoyed it too.
Well, but so you made it further than me in terms of liking it, because I was definitely actively disliking it as it was unfolding. But so is it, I mean, because yeah, I've read the book. I'm very familiar with the 1989 film. I've seen it way too many times. And I have a complicated relationship with it, because sometimes I feel like I don't like it. And then I just have to come to terms with the fact that, like, yes, I do, even though it pushes certain buttons in me that I don't like. And I feel like it walks a weird line between being sort of crass and being very effective. Is the filmmaker's obligation to your friend? Like, do they just have to make a movie that works for a person who knows nothing, who hasn't seen a trailer, who hasn't seen the movie, who hasn't read the book, who can go in cold and just appreciate this story? Or do they also have to make a movie that works for people like you and me? Who,
I mean, they have to make it for everybody.
I would think, right? Because I don't want to...
Because the majority of people, at the very least, know the concept of the story. They probably have seen, you know, little pieces. I feel like even if you haven't seen the movie or read the book, like, you know stuff from it. Just from, like, the pop culture zeitgeist kind of stuff. But, like, if it's a horror, it's not to say that every horror fan has, like, seen or read the book, but most have. Right. So it seems like you should work towards both.
Well, and so, you know, I was trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. Like, okay, maybe I'm not the audience for this movie. But, like, I totally am the audience for this movie. I'm a fan of them. I'm a fan of Stephen King. I'm a fan of Pet Sematary. And here we have to get into spoilers. Because there's a point that I want to make that requires spoiling the big change in this adaptation of the movie. So if you haven't seen the movie yet and you haven't seen the trailers and you don't want to be spoiled, turn this off. Come back to this moment after you've seen the podcast. After you've seen the movie, come back and listen to the podcast. Because I was trying to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, maybe this is for people who are just going in blind. But here's where that falls apart, for me at least. It seems like, you know, when you're going to remake a movie, I don't necessarily subscribe to this idea that we just have to tell the same story for every new generation. So just the fact that it's been 30 years, for me, is not reason enough to remake Pet Sematary. Mm-hmm. You have to do something new. You have to sort of justify why you are choosing to tell this story again right now, more than just like, well, we own the property and it's been enough time. And I couldn't find an answer to that, because the big reason that they come up with seems to be, well, this time it's the daughter. And that only works if you know the original. If you've read the book or if you've seen the movie, this only functions as a response to that, because I don't think killing the daughter instead of Gage changes the story in any fundamental way. It doesn't make the movie about something different. It's essentially about the same thing. It's just, it's this Star Trek Into Darkness thing where it's like, remember Wrath of Khan when Spock died? Well, this time we're going to do the same scene, but we're going to flip it and Kirk's going to die instead. And that's what this is. It's like, remember when Gage died? We're going to flip it. And this time it's going to be Ellie. And isn't that crazy? And it's like, okay, but why, except to plant your flag and say, well, we're different from the last one, only you're not. So it exists sort of in reaction to the original, which is why I feel like it doesn't exist in a vacuum. It can't only be for your friend.
Mm-hmm. Do you... Sorry. I don't.
That's how I feel when I talk about this movie too.
I don't know if, like, the killing Ellie instead stuff didn't work for me, because at least I thought they did an interesting job of, like, making her character a character. Like, I actually liked that actress. I thought she did a good job. The kid was cute. I think there's a point where, like, it almost seems like, if you didn't see the trailer, it seems like Gage is going to die.
Yeah, they really try to direct it that way, which again...
But at the same time, like, I kept forgetting Gage existed because, like, he would just not be there for a while. So right. I kept being like, if you killed him now, I'd be like, oh, it was like that kid that you guys gave us like 5 minutes with and I care about because he's a cute child, but like, it doesn't seem like these parents particularly care. like the spare child. But... So I was kind of like, oh, if you built him up more, maybe I would have been like, oh my God, like, and I hadn't seen the trailer, like, oh, they're going to kill him. This is horrible. And then obviously it's Ellie, which they did, you know, so many scenes of her talking about death and she becomes friends with Judd and all that stuff. But I don't know. I didn't dislike that twist, but I also don't know if I thought it.
It's completely lateral. Like, it doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it a worse movie, except for some of the... Again, I'm not a fan of remakes that want to keep reminding you of the last movie. And I feel like this movie does that a few too many times. Not, like, ever to a super obnoxious degree that the way some of them do. But even the stuff with the misdirection of Gage is like, we're going to kill Gage, we're going to kill Gage. And I feel like it's weird to play sort of that game of misdirection with the murder of a child. Like, to make that into this little game that you're playing with your audience, to me feels weird when then you do still murder a child, just not the one you promised you were going to murder.
What if they did that scene and, like, both kids lived and then later something happened? Because we all know it's like the busy street and a truck's going to come kind of thing, because that's what happens. But I don't know, if you're going to change things already, like, make it completely different. Make it like they both survive then, and then later when we're even less expecting it, she dies.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I just feel like if your movie has to go there, and it does, because that's what the movie's about, I just think it's a hard thing to fake us out, you know, because we know that that's what the story is. Again, those of us who've read the book or seen the original film. So it's almost you're spinning your wheels a little bit if you're trying to pretend like you're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Only to do it. You know, if you really want to fundamentally change it, I guess you'd have to not kill either kid, but then what do you do? Where do you go? So you have to, I guess, kill one of the kids. And I didn't particularly like the execution of that sequence either, with the truck tipping over. And I thought on a technical level that stuff didn't work. And that's part of what bummed me out too about the movie, is that I thought Starry Eyes was such a well-made film, and I was so excited by them stylistically. And this movie didn't give me very much stylistically, even as a piece of filmmaking to hold on to, that I was kind of rolling my eyes a lot of times at some of the story choices, or not a lot of it worked for me. But I wanted to at least be able to enjoy it as a piece of filmmaking, and I really wasn't even able to do that.
Did it kind of just feel like a mid-tier what's the word? Studio horror film that you'd get that would be like PG-13. That's just kind of, because I felt like sometimes I would felt a little bit like that. It was just like the way it looked.
Yeah.
Maybe you disagree.
No. I don't disagree at all. And I mean, maybe that's where some of my disappointment comes in, because again, I did have hope in these guys. And so for it to come across as pretty generic, like you said, was a disappointment. You know, they do, you know what they do? They play that same game of misdirection later on in the film with Judd's ankle. And there's a place where I think you can get away with it, because you're not talking about the murder of a child. So again, it depends on your knowing the original film and remembering this very sort of iconic moment where Fred Gwynne gets his ankle slashed. And it's very, very upsetting and painful to watch. And this movie plays games with that, where it's like, we're going to do it, we're going to do it, we're going to do it. And again, it's annoying that they depend on your memory of the original film, but okay, fine. And they don't do it. And then a few seconds later, like you said, they do it in a different way. And like that, I feel like you can get away with. You know, that's a little bit of like game playing that I'm fine with.
Yeah. And here, while I was seeing in theater, like while I was at theater, here's where maybe being familiar with it was kind of detrimental to my enjoyment, is like, because I hate anything with Achilles. I hate that stuff.
Yeah.
So I knew it was coming, and I like kind of just like quietly like put my head down so my hair was in my face and was like, I don't have my eyes closed, but I'm maybe not looking at the screen right now. And I just kept waiting. I'm like, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. I had the same things the first time when like, it was supposed to be Zelda stuff, because I was like, oh, it's Zelda. Zelda's coming. But then it wasn't as scary as I thought it would be.
Well, to be fair,
Nothing. I know.
Nothing can be as scary.
I want to ask them, how did you deal with the Zelda in this movie?
It was fine. I kind of rolled my eyes at it, which I feel bad about. But, like, I think, you know, part of the problem is that Zelda has never really been necessary to the story of Pet Sematary. No. Not even in the Stephen King book. It tries to inform a little bit of Rachel's character in terms of her feelings about death and some early childhood trauma that have informed who she is as an adult, where she's trying to deny certain things, right? And this movie tries to do a little bit of that. I feel like the first half of this movie tries to be a more faithful adaptation of the Stephen King book. I think the second half becomes wildly unfaithful and is far worse. But I think even in the book, and certainly in the Mary Lambert movie, like, Zelda is completely superfluous. She's really not necessary. The Mary Lambert version gets away with it because it's the scariest thing ever put on screen in any movie ever, right? And so it's like, well, it doesn't really belong in this movie, but I don't care because now I'll never sleep again, and I have this movie to blame. And so, you know, Pet Sematary 2019 has a lot to live up to. I don't think they ever even come close. So they don't really conquer the issue of, well, how do we deal with Zelda and make it necessary? They opt not to just cut it out, which probably would have been the smart thing. But I think they know, oh, but people coming to see Pet Sematary expect Zelda because it's so memorable and so scary in the original. So we have to do it. But instead, they don't do anything to even come close to living up to it.
One thing, and I've never really got this from the book or the 89, because, like, all of the Zelda stuff, when she starts, especially in this movie, when she's, like, seeing the ghost stuff, or, you know, the thing in the bathroom mirror, and she's hearing the noises and stuff, at that point, is she just, like, kind of crazy? Because, like, nothing's happened that should be causing a spirit or anything.
Well,
but then there's also the student, and you see him all the time before anything has happened. And I'm like, I don't, not that I need to always completely get the rules of a universe, but I don't get the rules of this universe at all.
Well, they do it halfway. I think they do it a little bit better than the 89 movie in terms of adhering to Stephen King's book, but I think it's to the detriment of the film, because the Stephen King book really makes a point of making it seem like there's some sort of supernatural force associated with the Pet Sematary that sort of draws people to it. Mm-hmm. And so some of the Zelda stuff or some of the Pascal stuff is sort of an extension of this supernatural force. I mean, there's talk of a Wendigo that's running through there. I mean, the book makes it. Yeah, well, right. And so this book just mentions it in passing, just like somebody holds up a drawing like, there's even a Wendigo. Anyway, moving on. Which doesn't.
I kept thinking you'd see it in the background, like running around.
Hey, it would have been something. It would have been something. Just hanging out, just asking Lewis if he needs help. Do you want me to? You want me to take over digging for a little while? I got nowhere to be.
Like, at one point, I think he, like, looks off in the distance through the woods, and I just was like, oh, he's going to turn away, and, like, some figure, like, Wendigo type thing is going to be right behind him. And I was like, no, it's not there.
It would not have surprised me, because the first half of this movie is just jump scare the movie, which bothered me, again, coming from these guys, and also because I just sat through, I don't know, three trailers, like, for The Curse of La Llorona and Annabelle Comes Home. And right, it's just all jump scares, right? So it's like, okay, I don't really need it in my Pet Sematary also. Anyway, so the book, you know, goes out of its way to talk about this sort of supernatural force. The 89 movie really doesn't do any of that. And so some of the things like Pascal and Zelda make even less sense. This movie tries to do some of that. It tries to suggest that there's this pull that's getting Lewis to do the things that he's doing. The problem is, A, it doesn't go far enough with it, so it doesn't work, because it never really commits to that idea. It sort of introduces it, tiptoes around it, but never really commits to the idea, so it doesn't work. But in doing so, it also sort of cuts the legs out from under it being an effective story about grief. And for all its faults, I think the 89 movie genuinely and honestly tries to deal with grief. It's in the context of a pretty ugly, pretty bleak horror movie, but I think it's actually talking about, hey, here are the things that we will do to prevent this feeling of loss. Here's the lengths that we will go to try to not feel sad anymore about something that we have lost and cannot get back. And I feel like by introducing enough of the supernatural stuff into this movie, it kind of hurts its chances at actually examining that. So it does it a little bit, but I feel like on paper only in the way that it sort of addresses grief. It kind of goes through some of the beats, but I never actually felt that the movie was really about any of that stuff, particularly as we get into the last couple minutes, is for me just a total train wreck.
The end does not work for me. I know that it seems like some people, because there's like the first three quarters and then the last quarter where it goes crazy. And as much as I wasn't loving the first three quarters, I was almost like, you know what, just make this a family drama. Just make it a family drama, right, and take out the horror stuff. Right. And like, it's well acted. It's, you know, I'm fine with this. And then it goes bananas for the last quarter. And I was like, oh, nope, nothing works for me. Like, it's that ending is very weird. We're in spoilers. Do we say what it is?
Oh, sure. Like, yeah.
Okay. Like, quick question. So they're all like demon things now, right? Like, they're not themselves. They're like possessed by spirit things.
Right.
And they have these bodies. Are they going to kill Gage? Like, are they going to be a little dead, creepy family?
Yeah.
What's their game plan from there?
Just like, in case you didn't know, they have the little sound of the car unlocking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He knocks and it just says that little beep, beep. So they're going to kill the kid, bury him. What's their game plan from there? Like, they just live in their creepy house?
Yeah, I believe.
Do they go and try to kill other people and bury them? And then
that gets hard. That gets hard to do. The further you spread out, I mean, you're talking about 6 hours driving back and forth just to bury someone in the pet cemetery. That gets tricky.
Are they going to head back to Boston? Like, what are they doing?
But I don't know. You know, they don't have sour ground in Boston, I don't think.
No, they don't. I will also say, being not that I live in Maine, but being like woods of New Hampshire, when they're walking through the woods, I was like, yeah, that's what our woods look like when I would go play in the woods as a kid. Didn't creep me out. It's not that scary.
Just kids walking around in animal masks, which is another touch that
we didn't have those.
Goes nowhere, also, tries
no
to be different. Well, right.
No child would ever do that. Because those kids weren't like creepy possessed children. They were just normal kids.
And not that I want them to have been creepy possessed children, but at least that would have been something and would have sort of tied into the ending of this movie.
Well, if it turns out the whole town is just actually spirits possessing dead people.
Right, or that there's way more of them than we realize, you know, but like it doesn't go. It's like, oh, it's a creepy visual, but so what? I don't think it adds anything. It's just something you could put in your marketing campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought the ending was a disaster. I liked Amy Simon saying, don't bury me in that place.
Which goes nowhere because she is.
Well, yeah, she's immediately buried in that place. But again,
I was going to say, how quickly does this thing work? Because like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know how Ellie buried her that quickly. He had to dig the hole, put the little cairn
thing on top of
her. The
Wendigo was there to help, actually.
That's true.
He really just hangs out in that spot, just hoping somebody will need help because he always has a shovel.
Like, they're dead and buried and back on their feet in like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Not even. I was like, that doesn't make sense.
Not really, no.
I don't know. I feel like I'm nitpicking, but just...
But I don't know if you are, because, again, these are the changes that they made, you know, because otherwise we're just kind of talking about the movie in general, which is a generic adaptation of Pet Sematary that, to me, has very little visual personality, has fine performances, nothing, I don't, especially memorable, I don't think.
Did you like John Lithgow?
I thought he was fine. I feel like he has too much to live up to, because for as ridiculous as Fred Gwynne sounds in the original Pet Sematary, like, he's the living embodiment of that character, and he's just so memorable. He's so, it's like at this towering performance, and he's so memorable. And it's a lot to live up to. And I don't, mm-hmm. in most cases, I feel like they didn't really try. And then when they did, I feel like they made the wrong choices when it was like, well, here's how we can differentiate ourselves. And then other times it was just like, hey, remember Pet Sematary? Yeah, we do too. Here's that song you remember during the end credits. We're going to do the same thing, only it's, you know, a cover, which is what the whole movie feels like. It just feels like a kind of a lame cover version.
Yeah. I will not disagree with that. I wish I liked the movie a lot so that we could
Me too.
Have had very different. I think I'm, again, I stuff did work. I didn't find it scary, which is not a, you know, not a requirement for a horror movie. I jumped a lot, but that was just, like you said, there was a million jump scares. And we, my friend and I saw it in like the Dolby.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was just loud. Like anytime there was, I was like, it's just loud. It hurt my ears. I don't know if there was any real difference beyond that. Maybe the picture was better. I don't know. Most of the movie's dark.
Yeah, it's not like a really well shot movie. There was one big jump that freaked Erica out. And then she turned to me and she was like, did that not get you at all? And I wasn't trying to be tough guy. I just was like, no.
Which one?
It was like maybe the second jump scare where just a truck comes flying out of nowhere.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, like, do those just not bother you anymore? And that's not the case. And again, I'm not trying to be Mr. Like, you can't scare me. But I think I was just annoyed. And that's the mm-hmm. problem was that, like, it didn't make me jump. It just annoyed me and disappointed me because, like I said, I was coming off of these other trailers and I wanted more than just loud noises from this movie. Mm-hmm. And so when it happened, I was like, ugh, really? Instead of, and maybe that's my fault. Maybe I needed to be more open-minded, giving myself over to the movie a little bit more. I don't know. Maybe I did have a bad attitude. I didn't think
no,
I did, but maybe I did.
I don't think you did. Cause again, I went in like really, really wanting to like it. I can't say I had fun. It's not a fun movie. I mean, it's not
no,
a fun
not.
Concept at all. So, okay. This is just like story question.
Yeah.
Judd, did he try to bury his wife? Did he kill his wife? I didn't understand the whole when Ellie's like face turned into his wife's face scene.
That, again, to me was just another weird supernatural, like, look what we can do. We're the demons from the Pet Sematary. I mean, it's in the original, in the book, you know, his wife is a character. She dies of natural causes or she's sick. She has cancer, maybe. And she dies, and he doesn't try to bury her or anything like that. So I don't think that that's suggested.
Okay, because it's like, I don't know, the way that the wife or the demon putting like the wife's face on is acting, and then like it just, you know, kind of seems like she had a vendetta or like he must have done something. And I was like, and then I think he like. Maybe calls her like a bitch or something. And I was like, what's happening here?
Well, and in the book, again, this is the second movie in a row to cut the character of Judd's wife, which, okay, fine, I guess for economy, you have to cut down on some characters, but
don't put that scene in then.
Right. And I want to say that that's the whole impetus for him showing Lewis the Pet Sematary in the first place. Like, Lewis helps him out a lot with his wife. And so when she dies and he's sad and then the cat dies, he's like, well, you did this kindness for me. Now I'm going to do this kindness for you.
Whereas in this, he's just like, I like Ellie a lot. And
yeah,
that,
right.
That was pretty
he's
nice.
Like,
let me pet it.
Right.
So
oh, your cat died? Let me
terribly. Turn
it into a demon cat, which again speaks to like, is he drawn to it because of this whole supernatural thing? They hint at that, but it doesn't go
Church
far enough with
that. Doesn't seem that bad. The cat does not seem that bad.
Well, he scratches Ellie, and then he scares Gage,
like,
and Gage is crying.
Out. Yeah, the Gage, like, maybe get the cat out of the thing. But then also, when he's going to, like, poison the cat, and he, like, can't bring himself to do it, I was like, you know what? You could have solved all your problems right then.
Right.
But also, I don't know. It was just, like, I will say, and then this is because they always have, like, the line of the sometimes dead is better.
Yeah.
That came at a point that, like, I was not expecting it. I didn't expect it to happen, like, pre-Ellie dying or anything like that. It was just him, like, chatting away and mentioning it. And I was like, oh, I really thought this was going to be, like, you trying to be, like, don't do this.
Right.
Don't do this horrible right. thing. And instead, it's just like they're shooting the shit and he mentions right. it. Like, what?
Yeah. No, nothing feels especially thought through. It's almost like kind of a lousy first draft that they shot. And I do feel like it's ultimately a failure of the screenplay. And I don't want to, you know, necessarily assign blame to just the one person. I think it's Jeff Bueller who's credited with writing the screenplay. Because for all I know, a lot changed between the draft that he turned in and what they shot. So I learned my lesson a long time ago that just because the person is credited as the screenwriter, but, you know, a lot of times that's who we have to talk about because that's mm-hmm. that's all we have. That's all we have to go by. Right. But I do feel like it's a failure of screenplay above anything else because it's directed competently, just not particularly interestingly. The acting is fine. Like I said, I didn't love any particular performance, but I don't think anybody does a bad job.
Yeah.
But it all just feels like half formed. Even, you know, that stuff with the ending is just like, I don't know. To me, it doesn't go any further than like, wouldn't it be fucked up if ... And that to me isn't justification for that ending.
No, it's the ending. I feel like if I had been with the movie much more, even then that ending wouldn't have worked for me. And like, if an ending doesn't work, it's kind of ruins the whole movie.
Right.
Like, I was like, oh, that's my last thing is the creepy family standing at the car and the little beep beep, and I was like, all right, cool, that's a thing.
Because it's all very rushed also, you know, like
it seem like everything happens in like 7 minutes.
Yeah.
I get wanting to build it and maybe you want to get us to feel more about Ellie and everything, but I don't know. Not that you want like a super long movie or longer movie, but like maybe Ellie dies earlier and maybe it takes a longer time for like the switch to happen, which I get that like she's already kind of a creepy possessed thing as soon as she comes back into the house, but like maybe it's a little bit of a slower burn to her being like psychotic and trying to kill people, because it goes from her like laying in bed next to him and being like, hey, guess what, I know I was dead, also I never want mom to come home, to freaking out dancing, to like, ugh, I'm gonna stab my mom in the back, like I'm going to murder her now. And that like appears to happen in the course of like 2 hours.
Like, right.
It's like, and she's, I'm assuming she probably doesn't sleep. I don't think they need to sleep, but she has like the through the night and then like the next day. I don't know. The switch between when he's like bathing her and like brushing her hair and she's creepy, but she's still able to communicate as like, he's still able to talk to her. And then like when they're laying in the bed and she's like kind of talking to him, I almost wanted more of that as it like, but like a slow kind of descent from that into really crazy. And instead it was okay, slightly creepy to she's completely psychotic right. and everybody's dead.
Right.
And I was like, that doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, no, it really just kind of steps on the gas. And I got to say, I didn't like a lot of the creepy kid scenes because again, it just felt like this generic holdover from a million creepy kid movies. And, you know, no fault of the actress. I believe her name is Jette Lawrence, who's a fine child actor, but like is definitely playing those scenes like she knows she's a creepy kid in a movie and she's doing a certain voice and a certain look. And it's like, it becomes less creepy when the kid knows that she's being creepy. I will say, I did think they did kind of a weird droopy eye thing on one of her eyes.
Yes,
I thought that
was
very effective.
And then I spent a little while being like, was her eye like that before?
I don't think it was.
I feel like I would have noticed.
Or we're both horrible people who are like, yeah, we love that droopy eye. And it just turns out it's like a weird birth thing that she has.
Yeah, right? I thought that was interesting. Like even like the like her skin being kind of translucent. I was like, no, that worked for me. The look of her worked for me. Now, is she playing it as like a creepy kid who knows she's a creepy kid because she's really a demon possessing this body? Because I assume that, like, once this happens to them, the actual soul of that person is just, like, gone and it's something else.
I think that's what it is. I don't know that something else is in its place, just that the soul is gone.
Okay.
And I guess without our soul, we all become zombie murderers.
But then she also keeps saying, like, hey, when I kill you now, you're going to go to hell. And I was like, wait, by, like, burying your child in this place, did you send her to hell? Because that's awful.
Yes, any one of these would be more interesting if the movie actually dealt with that idea. Because, like, as you were talking about, like, her saying, you know, I know I'm dead, I know I was dead. A slower build towards her going crazy, like, would have been more interesting if we're actually watching the daughter sort of in torment. Not that I want to see a child tormented, but at least there's something horrifying about that. Or about a dad realizing that he condemned his daughter to hell by burying her in this place.
Yes.
By trying to stave off his grief, he condemned his daughter to a life in hell. Like, that's a horrifying concept. Something beyond the mom just saying, like, don't bury me in that place. And then 2 seconds later, I'm buried in that place and she's back. Like, the idea that coming back from the pet cemetery is worse than death. That notion could be interesting if they sort of built it up a little bit more instead of just one throwaway line of dialogue that's immediately negated. Like, there's all these things that, hey, could have been interesting.
Yeah.
Even the original film, you know, for as weird as it gets, when Gage comes back and the dad has to give him an injection in his neck and kill him again, like, that's horrible. And that's,
yeah,
like, part of his punishment for transgressing and burying his kid in the pet cemetery. Part of his punishment is now he has to live for however long with having to murder his own kid again. And that's horrifying and that's horrible, but it's effective, which this movie does not do.
No, in this movie, he was going to take a shovel to his daughter's neck.
Right,
like,
right.
Almost without hesitation.
Right.
And, like, I don't have kids, but I feel like parents would have, like, even if that was a creepy possessed child, would be like, maybe I don't want to behead my own child.
Yeah, right.
Like, I'm assuming. But the original, and I think they did this in the 89, I know in the book, doesn't he bury his wife?
So in
the book,
the 89, he does.
Okay.
Ends with her, like, coming back and she's all, like, messed up. She's, like, missing an eye, and it ends with them kissing and her possibly killing him. The book, I want to say, ends with...
Because I think the book ends with, like, darling. Like, she, like, puts her hand on his shoulder. Like, she's back.
That is for sure the movie. I feel like the book is just him carrying her, like, over the hill. Like, there's, like, a neighbor or a friend who's in the book that's not in any of the movies. And as he passes by, he sees Lewis taking her to bury her in the pet cemetery. I think, like, I read it not that long ago, and my memory is that it's hinted that, yes, that's where he's going.
So,
but we don't get the aftermath the way we do in the 89.
So wouldn't that... In this movie, and again, this is just, like, them changing things to change things, when she has the line of, like, don't bury me there, I feel like it would have been even more kind of horrifying if the end of the movie was him going to bury her, being like,
yes,
you know what, I know you said this, but
yes,
I can't live without you,
yes,
and I have not learned my lesson.
Yes.
But
then the movie might be about something.
But somehow, did they get super strength? Is that why Ellie is able to, like, drag her mom miles into the woods?
I don't even know. Also... At what point did the mom learn exactly what the pet cemetery is and does enough to know, don't bury me there? Is there a scene that I'm forgetting?
I thought he told her, like, I buried church and church came back and then I buried our daughter. And she's like, that's not our daughter. Do you?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay,
daughter?
See, that is a scene I'm forgetting. You're absolutely right. So he does explain it. So she does know enough to say, don't bury me there. Okay.
And then she takes a nap and dreams about Zelda, which
like
not a time
do.
To take a nap. Like, what?
That's not our daughter. All right, wake me in an hour.
That was the thing. It's like, and she wakes up to being, like, attacked and stabbed. But I was like, wait, why would you take a nap now? Like, maybe get your kid out of there. Don't go upstairs.
Well, this was a disappointment. This was.
I really wanted to like it.
Me too. me too. There's all these things going for it. I thought the cast was good, you know, as they were announcing it, and I had my hopes up, But yeah, I just couldn't get on board with most of it, unfortunately. So that's too bad. Anything else about Pet Sematary you want to bring up?
No, I feel like I was mean enough.
No, I know. And I don't like necessarily doing these kinds of episodes where we're both just like, yeah, what's up with this? But this movie left me scratching my head and frustrated. And
I really thought I was like, I'll be kind of mixed. And I was like, he'll maybe like it and he can like talk me into it a little more.
I think you talked me out of it. Yay. Not my goal. I think I suspected that you didn't love it. You texted me like, I have a lot of thoughts. And I was like, well, nobody ever says that when they love something. Nobody ever says, I have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, I realized that when I was like, can't wait for you to see it. I have a lot of thoughts. I need to talk about it.
Very rarely do people say that when they're so excited about something and they love it. Although sometimes maybe they do, but not in this case. Anyway, I'm really glad that we were able to make this work and that we both got to see this movie. It's a bummer that we didn't love it, but if nothing else, it made me gave me a greater appreciation for the 1989 version.
Yeah, I'm glad I got to be on and talk about something that wasn't like a creepy child's movie. I mean,
yeah, it's just a movie with creepy children in it.
Yes. Okay, well, there we go.
You can't get away from the creepy childhood, I guess, is what we're saying. Anyway, thank you again, as always. Thank you guys all for listening. Remember, you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us, rate us, review us wherever you get your podcasts. Tweet us at we're at fthismovie. And what else? Read us every day at fthismovie.com. And go vote for us in the rondos if you haven't already. Thank you, Robin. This was super fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.